Tom Woods Show, episode 1565.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Folks, the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, which I helped create, gives parents their mental health back and students a top-notch education. In addition to the traditional subjects, how about 2 years worth of business, as well as a course on personal finance for teens, a course on public speaking, the kinds of stuff nobody learns anywhere, but which will give your students a major leg up. Plus, through my link only, get $160 worth of free bonuses when you join. That link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Jeff Deist Week continues. Jeff, remember, is former chief of staff to Ron Paul, president of the Mises Institute, all-around good guy and profoundly underrated thinker. And today I want to talk about decentralization and secession as approaches that would be fruitful and humane if only anybody would entertain them. Jeff, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Tom.
All right, let's pick up with a couple quick things about the Mises Institute, and then I want to talk about decentralization and secession, because people want to know what really is the way forward here. You know, you just vote and vote and vote. And, you know, my Woods's law is no matter, you know, you vote all you like and you always wind up with John McCain. In the final analysis, it always ends up being John McCain. You look at the policies that you get, it's John McCain over and over and over. But before that, I want to pick up on something that sort of came up in passing in the previous episode. And that has to do with the Mises Institute, of which you are the president. Now, for background, the Mises Institute was founded in 1982. And it had on its board and as cheerleaders and sympathizers, people like Margaret von Mises, the wife of Ludwig von Mises, Henry Hazlitt, and numerous other people of distinction. Henry Hazlitt was particularly enthusiastic about the Mises Institute, and he told Lou Rockwell that the greatest contribution the Mises Institute was going to make was giving a platform to Murray Rothbard. So, you know, these days it's fashionable to hate Murray Rothbard, hate Lou Rockwell. But, you know, when you do that, I mean, just as long as you understand that that also means you're basically hating Henry Hazlitt, Mises, all these other people. And as long as you know, I mean, maybe you're okay with that. I'm just telling you, that's what's implied when you take that particular position. Well, anyway, the Mises Institute has attracted some opposition over the years. And what I always love is none of these people who criticize the Mises Institute, they'd never read the Mises Institute blog. Never, not once. You go to the Mises Institute blog, what do you find there? Sinister, evil things? No, just libertarian commentary on current events. Or if they look at the conference topics of the Austrian Economics Research Conference every year, it's all highly technical economic papers. There's no white nationalism in it or whatever it is they expect to find over there. There's no Confederate reenactors. That, like, whatever. I don't know what they think goes on at the Mises Institute. But if you actually just look at the proceedings of all the events, it's basically a libertarian Austrian economics center, just as it advertises itself. So do you want to say at least a little something about that?
Well, people may not know, but Henry Hazlitt's estate left the Mises Institute money that helped build our first building and helped us get off campus. We were renting space from Auburn University prior to that. So his bequest to us upon his death in the 90s was actually a big source of funding for the Mises Institute. So I think that's an interesting tidbit. And of course, there are people who dislike Hazlitt. They don't know too many of them, but they're out there. People forget that when Mises died in 73, there wasn't much of what we would call Austrian economics. I mean, Hayek had not yet won his Nobel. He would a year later. The South Royalton Conference, which sort of resuscitated things, hadn't happened. Murray Rothbard had produced Man, Economy, and State in the early 60s, so that was sort of a new text or tome to plant the flag out there. But things were not particularly rosy, not only from the perspective of where politics and economics were going generally, but also, you know, Mises's worldview. People who have picked up his memoirs, which most of which were written, you know, much earlier, way back in the 40s, will find that he would occasionally allow himself to get into gloominess. I think there's no question about that. And so today, fast forward 3 or 4 decades, and of course, Mises is far more widely known and read than he ever was during his life. And a lot of that, not all of that, is due to the efforts of the Mises Institute. Lots of other good people, too, of course, promote Mises. But it's also due, let's be frank, to the digital revolution. You know, now you can, anyone anywhere in the world in multiple languages can basically read Mises instantly for free. So, I mean, that's something he could not have imagined during his lifetime. And I think he would be cheered by that almost unfathomable development since his death. And so, you know, I certainly like to think of the Mises Institute as a new form of school, as a different kind of school. First and foremost, is a place that educates people, but without all the trappings and costs and bureaucracy of a regular school. But you know, if we were nothing else, if we were nothing but a museum designed to keep alive and keep available the writings of Mises, Hayek, Rothbard, Menger, Bamberger, et cetera, I think that alone would be a huge service to humanity. So I do think that it's important the Mises Institute exists. I do think it's proper and well and good that we go beyond just pure econ and explore some of the other areas of politics and philosophy that, of course, Mises himself explored. And let's not forget, really up until even well into the 20th century, in the early 20th century, economics wasn't even really thought of as a standalone discipline. You know, it was considered part and parcel of kind of social sciences. And so the idea that we have economists who do nothing else and that they should stay in their lane and not talk about these other things, that's a pretty recent development. So, you know, look, again, no apologies for what we do. I don't believe in explaining or apologizing. I think we do important work. And I think we appeal perhaps more narrowly, but more deeply to a subset of economics or libertarian people out there. And if we're not your cup of tea, I understand. God bless you. Go, if you arrive at a more libertarian worldview from reading David Friedman or you know, and you don't much care for Hoppe or Rothbard, that's entirely up to you. So, you know, sometimes I'm just a little mystified by the idea that the Mises Institute's existence is somehow a thorn in the lion's paw or something. I don't quite get that. I mean, our crime is getting, you know, many hundreds of thousands of people across the world to read more Mises, to read more Hayek, to read more Menger, et cetera. And I think that's an unqualified good.
Let me transition into what we want to talk about today with this point, that some of the folks who have, let's say, been unsympathetic to the Mises Institute are part of a Washington, D.C.-oriented approach to the problem, and by the problem, I mean the problem of liberty versus power, that consists of imagining that someday what we'll do is have libertarian Supreme Court justices who will enforce liberty all over America. So again, it'll be a top-down, centrally planned approach. And the Mises Institute, not as an organization, but the scholars associated with it, have tended to look at the question somewhat differently, not favoring what has sometimes been called libertarian centralism of that sort, that uses the 14th Amendment and stuff like that, but rather that is highly decentralist in nature, that favors radical decentralization and secession. Well, of course, the strategy of putting libertarians on the Supreme Court is not something the New York Times favors, but at least you're playing by the New York Times' rules, which is these are the institutions we have and we got to work within those confines. I think it's safe to say the scholars of the Mises Institute are much less interested in playing by those rules or being concerned that the New York Times is going to think we're not respectable. I realize decentralization is not respectable, but there's a tremendous American history of it. And no, the decentralist tradition is not inherently tied up with slavery, as anybody who knows the history knows. And you can read that history in my book, Nullification. But the point is, it doesn't matter to me that the New York Times doesn't approve of decentralization. It is obviously the only humane solution in a society like ours where there are people with such divergent worldviews that it's pointless and stupid and evil to try to force them to live under the same set of rules together. Why would you want to do that? I mean, we've all been kind of brainwashed into thinking that's the only way to go, and any other approach is neo-Confederate or whatever BS they're throwing at you. The only way for us to live is this inhumane way of having a low-intensity civil war with each other where we just try to force each other round holes into square pegs. And there are humane people among us who say, how about we lay down our arms and stop doing this? And we're the ones who are demonized and evil, and you probably support slavery. I mean, Oh, again, I wish I could be attacked by H.L. Mencken, because at least then it would be entertaining.
Let's not forget Mises wrote quite a bit about this. He was very concerned with political minorities in a society being overrun, and in particular linguistic minorities. Now, you have to understand, he was coming out of this sort of patchwork quilt of old Europe, and Germany was many, many principalities, and you had the Habsburg Empire and all these things coming together and then changing radically after World War I in particular, and again after World War II. Many of these boundaries were redrawn. And so Mises himself, of course, always advocated this, the idea that political minorities ought to be allowed to break away from a centralized state. I think that the centralizing impulse is almost always a statist impulse. I don't like the idea that we all have to live in some sort of mass democracy. 320 million people, I think, is a very unwieldy thing to make decisions about with two parties, you know, and either Trump's going to win in fall of 2020 or Hillary maybe Hillary or Bernie or Elizabeth Warren or whomever's going to win. And this is going to be, again, this binary thing that a bunch of us have to sort of uneasily accept. And I don't think that's very healthy. I think that smaller administrative units are always preferable, you know, and we have a history in the United States that unfortunately makes the idea of secession or moving decentralization attached to this, to the Confederacy and to slavery and to the Civil War. Look, that's a bad history, but that doesn't nullify the underlying doctrine of allowing people to peaceably walk away from political arrangements that just aren't working anymore. I mean, you don't have to be for the Confederacy to believe that. You don't have to be a Confederate, neo-Confederate, to think that Lincoln was a bad guy and a centralizer and a tyrant. I mean, this is just, you know, this kind of binary thinking needs to be thrown out the window. It's so obvious, it's staring us in the face, is that this is the way forward. And of course, if the Constitution had been followed somewhat, it did set up a federal system where states would have had a lot more power and authority over social and cultural and criminal matters. And, you know, we could have had a much higher degree of federalism, which would have been a release valve of sorts to let some of the steam out. But when we have, maybe a few hundred people in the U.S. House or Senate deciding things for 320 million, or in many cases, five Supreme Court justices out of nine deciding things for 320 million people. That is a recipe for strife and dissent and disaster. I mean, there's absolutely no reason why we have to have one unified, let's say, abortion rule for all 50 states or one form of gun laws for all 50 states. Now, I realize there is some localized gun control, don't get me wrong. It's a bad idea. And I think we understand that on some level, but libertarians have tended to insist, oh, no, no. You know, smaller is not necessarily better. A smaller government, you know, being ruled by at the local level or the regional level or the state level could be, you know, just as bad or worse for liberty. So that's not the yardstick which we use to measure things. Well, all right, let's not forget that liberty is not a majority position. Most people believe in a pretty robust government, especially when it comes to their own things like Social Security, right? So the idea that smaller isn't better is, I think, mystifying, because we always want to break up state power. We'd always prefer having two states exercise dominion, let's say over 20 million people each, than one state exercising dominion over 40 million people. I think we can understand that centralization means that the contagion is broader and wider, and then there's fewer choices and there's fewer chances for experiments. Obviously, I'm a big fan of the Swiss system of subsidiarity. I think it's probably about the best thing we have in the world today, far from perfect, but the idea of pushing decisions down to the communal level or the cantonal level, as opposed to deciding them federally, I think is very healthy. And I think it gives Switzerland a degree of social cohesion that big states, big governments don't have. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the Swiss government's website, they actually say in about four or five different languages, because the Swiss are so good at this sort of thing, they actually say, you know what, the desire here is to have social cohesion. You know, imagine Trump or Bernie campaigning in 2020 and going around and, you know, going to Des Moines, Iowa, or New Hampshire, or South Carolina, one of the early primary states, and saying, you know, I'm here today to tell you that I don't really know what's best for the farmers here in Iowa, because I'm not a farmer and I don't really study crop commodity prices, and I don't know about all these Byzantine ag subsidies. The whole thing's really complex. And then there's weather on top of that. It's really localized. So my promise to you today as a candidate is that if you vote for me, I'm going to let Iowa decide as much as possible at the local level. I mean that, imagine, that's the opposite of what politicians in the U.S. and in the West say. That's the opposite of hubris. It would be such a breath of fresh air to say, you know, I don't know what's best for you. I'm going to let you have a closer stab at deciding it. And look, Tom, go back to the first Congress. America only had a 6 million people or something in the outset. And if we extrapolated the number of U.S. representatives and senators at the time to today, we'd have something like 5,000 or 6,000 members of Congress. And unless you lived in some really rural part of Alaska or something, you'd probably be within a couple miles or maybe a mile of your U.S. representative. And so all that has gone out the window with this country of 320 million people, where everything's decided in D.C. And let's not forget that even if a libertarian position wins at the Supreme Court, that could easily be reversed, right? I mean, the makeup of the Supreme Court can change. So I'm a big believer in saying, look, let states be states. I don't care about liberty to the point of imposing it on others. That's paraphrasing Mencken. And there are plenty of people in the United States who absolutely do not hold a libertarian worldview. And the idea that you are going to slowly over time convert all of them, I think, is a pretty daunting task. But you can certainly convert a sizable enough portion of them to form a geopolitical union of sorts. I mean, you know, there are fully functioning countries like Norway that just have 6 or 8 million people. And you could, you know, if you believe that Cato study from a few years back, that maybe 10% of Americans are pretty libertarian in their worldview, that's 30 million people right there. I mean, that's plenty of people to have a country. Now, how you would assemble them geographically is a different question. But I'm a firm believer that from both a pragmatic perspective and also from a philosophical perspective of not imposing anything on other people, that this is what we have to be thinking about. And there are huge problems. We may never be able to undo, you know, Social Security and Medicare, which are federal programs. Okay. You know, you've paid into it, you want to get your money, whatever your position is. But when you move away, when you go to a foreign country like the Philippines to retire, you still get Social Security. You still qualify for Medicare. You might have to come to the U.S. for a Medicare-eligible doctor. But, you know, military bases and federal land. Yeah, okay. It would be very, very tough to divvy that up. I get it. You know, ports, natural resources, all of these things, you know, people might fight over rather than just break up peaceably. But the idea that we dismiss out of hand as libertarians, the idea of any kind of subsidiarity or federalism or secession or political breakup, I think it's just crazy. I don't understand this centralizing impulse from people who admittedly, by their own admission, are part of a minority viewpoint. It doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, I would rather let a state like Utah, which it's actually far less culturally and socially conservative today than people imagine it. But let's say Utah 40, 50 years ago, a culturally and socially conservative state, not entirely, but full of Mormons. You know, if they wanted to have different laws on divorce or, you know, more draconian drug laws or, you know, different laws on for prostitution, okay, I mean, you can, maybe Nevada would be the opposite. Maybe Nevada would say, hey, come here, you can get divorced in a day. Come here, you can use whatever kind of drugs you care to use because the drug war isn't federalized. Come here, you can, you know, view pornography or go to adult clubs. Come here, you can drink at any age. You can stay out and drink on the street, walk around with a beer until 5 a.m. We don't care. I mean, is that the worst possible outcome? Is that really so noxious to the libertarian worldview? Or do we have to say, no, you know, the whole country has to be libertarian. And so I'll leave you with this, the knock on states' rights. Oh my gosh, that goes back to the Civil War. And that was just an excuse for states that wanted to continue holding slaves. Look, states' rights doesn't mean that we're saying states have rights. It means relative to the people, and nobody That's just ridiculous. Nobody argues that. States' rights means that individual states in the union have hold rights vis-a-vis the federal government. That's all it ever meant. It didn't mean states have rights. States are just a smaller political entity. It doesn't mean they have particular rights against the people. So that was, it was always a canard and a red herring. And so I'm not only mystified, I'm a little discouraged sometimes that this isn't the conversation, because this is a conversation where we can be having this with the left. You want to talk about outreach to the left? I mean, what the left has found out, especially in 2016, is that there's a lot more deplorables than they thought, and that they're lingering a lot longer than they thought. When I say lingering, I mean the demographic changes aren't happening as fast as the left thought. So, you know, we could give blue states a bargain today and say, you know, you, right now, today, you could have a lot more of what you want without worrying about whether red state Alabama is going to elect Jeff Sessions back to the Senate and he's going to have a vote over some abortion law, which is really just being run up the flagpole for testing before the Supreme Court. I mean, that's ridiculous. Why should someone in Nancy Pelosi's district, and they vote for her something like 80%, by the way, for re-election. Why should someone in Nancy Pelosi's district have to worry about Jeff Sessions in Alabama? I don't want him to have to worry about it. That's, you know, I think it's just, it's the peaceable way forward. I think that was the title of one of your talks a few years ago at an event of ours in Houston on secession. It's the obvious solution staring us all in the face, but this insistence that we can't get divorced and we all have to stay with a spouse in a bad marriage. Oh man, that's I think a huge mistake. So I really would recommend that people go read just select passages in Mises's Liberalism, written in 1927 and about 10 years earlier in 1919 in Nation, State, and Economy, where he talks about, you know, these mechanisms for allowing political minorities to go their own way, because I think every word of that reads absolutely true and applicable today.
All right, I've got a couple of follow-ups, which I will fire at you in just a minute. All right, let's have 2020 be a year that you keep your New Year's resolutions. Make it a year where you explore new skills, deepen your existing passions, get lost in creativity, and you can do this with Skillshare's online classes. Skillshare offers thousands of classes in business, writing, photo and film, design, animation, illustration, and many more. And when you join, you get access to all of them. And these are classes designed for real life, so you can move your creative journey forward without putting life on hold. You can learn and grow with these short classes that fit your busy routine. With the skills you learn on Skillshare, you can enhance a currently existing interest, or you can build up skills that can make you more employable, or even help you build your own side hustle. I myself am interested in a very popular new class, Real Productivity, How to Build Habits That Last. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods and get 2 free months of premium membership. That's access to the thousands and thousands of classes at Skillshare for 2 months for free. Head over to Skillshare.com/woods and start your membership now with your 2 free months. When we talk about this, I can't help thinking to myself that, you know, I don't fit into either red or blue. I just don't. Because the blue side of the thing makes me crazy. These people make me crazy. And then I think, here we go. I'm going to hang around with some conservatives, and at least I've got something in common with them. And then I just remember the worst stuff about them, and I think, oh, like, for instance, you've had years at this point, years and years and years and years of the internet, and you're still, I haven't kept up with conservatives in a long time because I haven't gone to their conferences. I haven't spoken. I just haven't. I got a lot of invites under Obama. And so I spoke to a lot of Tea Party groups, and I haven't spoken to them in a long time. They've had all these years to learn about foreign intervention, the drug war, the truth about the police, the truth about all these topics, and the president is not your friend. And then I go back, and they're still saying, you know, back the blue, and he's my president, and you better say the Pledge of Allegiance. And I think, that's who you still are? Like, you've endured years and years of being exploited by the regime and lied to and ripped off, and you're still exactly where you were philosophically at the beginning. You've learned nothing. There's no nuance at all. So I can't stand these people either. So even if we do have secession, what I fear will happen is something somebody in my private group said the other day. I fear the blue section becomes more oppressively blue, and the red part becomes more oppressively red. The things that make them most identifiably red, which is we want a law against this, a law against that, then they're going to have free rein on that. And where the heck do I go? Where do the rest of us go? Where do the libertarians go? Where do that 10% go in that scenario?
Very tough question, and not one that's easily solved. I mean, we've seen just over the past couple of days the response, not amongst all conservatives. I mean, there are the Tucker Carlsons of the world.
Oh, I agree. And I always point those out, but there should be way more of those.
Right. And of course, going, you know, trying to gin up a war with Iran, a country of 80 million people after all of our history in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last almost 20 years now. I mean, any conservatives cheering for that, you know, at this point, I'm with you. I'm not exactly sure what you can say to these people. But again, if we are really this hardwired into these kind of tribes, and it seems like hardwiring because reason and evidence don't necessarily change people's views all the time. We can't always argue people out of seeing the world a certain way. You know, where does that leave libertarians? Again, I think it leaves us arguing for breakup and saying, let's break this thing into some individual pieces where we can have more of what we want. Other people can have more of what they want here and now. I've heard different people say this. I've heard Angela Keaton from Anti-War say this. By the way, she hates my guts. I'll just add that. That it's easier to teach the left economics than it is to teach the right peace.
I don't think that's not been my experience.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting comment.
I just went on this tirade against the right, and yet even after that, I'll say when they do have enough curiosity to listen, I can get them to change much, much more successfully than I can get the left to learn economics. Because they think of economics as a sham science that was developed to rationalize greed. Well, how do you talk to somebody like that?
Yeah, that's right. The left doesn't believe economics is a real discipline. They think it's just intellectual cover for corporate interests or wealth. I guess this is outs me as a right libertarian of sorts in that I think you can talk to the right about limits or areas of human conduct or existence where government ought not to be involved. Whereas the left tends to say everything is political, everything is power struggle, everything is critical theory, everything is race, everything is gender, everything is sex and sexuality. And I can't respond to that. At some point, you just say that's crazy, and we should go our separate ways. So while I think both left and right are equally bad ideologically when it comes to their pure political worldviews, I certainly think the left has more power. I think the left is a tiger. I think the right is a pussycat. And I think the idea that some sort of nasty left socialist oligarchy run by the Tim Cooks of the world is going to grind us down is far more likely than, you know, a Mike Huckabee right theocracy is going to grind us down. I think that's just the reality of where we are today. But it's a tough question. And seeing the bellicosity on Twitter towards Iran these last few days, it's been pretty disheartening. We have work to do.
All right. And as do you and I, we've got two more days worth of Jeff Deist week that we have to cut through like a hot knife through butter. We're just about to go do that. On this topic of secession, well, you know what? On the show notes page, which would be tomwoods.com/1565, I do want to point out that I'm going to link to my book Nullification, because the history in there of decentralization but in particular the history of really the nature of the American Union and the debates about it, and the American Union being a collection of societies rather than a single whole, I think it's just very important for Americans to understand this is actually where you come from. This is what we're talking about here is not foreign to you. So I'll link to that there, tomwoods.com/1565. All right. Thanks, Jeff. More to come tomorrow. All right, folks, there are a lot of things you can secede from, not just the crummy regime, but also the crummy boss you hate and the crummy job that's making you miserable. Build something on the side. Build up something for yourself on the side. And you know I promote different ways of doing that. And we mentioned Skillshare today in this program. And also, I have a free ebook on the subject, of course. I mean, what else, right? What do you expect from old Woods here? So check that out at pathstoincome.com. You got to check that out just for how minimalist that squeeze page is. It tells you nothing, and yet people sign up for that thing in droves. I just love it. Human psychology fascinates me. Pathstoincome.com is my little ebook about things I do to avoid working for the man. So check that out. We'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.